Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
This growing indifference to a democracy in the United States, indeed hostility to it, is being covered over in part by a great increase, not a little, but a great increase in talk about democracy, particularly as a way of rationalizing our policy abroad.
Bertel Ullman is our guest this time. Our topic is a new project called the International Endowment for Democracy, or IED. The nonprofit was set up in order to promote democracy. The real thing, says Bertel Ullman, not the hypocritical version. The website of IED is IEFD.org. IED will work to promote free elections, democratic nation building, progressive media, workers' rights, and better education. Bertel Ullman is president. Other officers include Howard Zinn, Gore Vidal, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Michael Ratner, Ramsey Clark, Barbara Foley, Michael Parenti, Emmanuel Wallerstein. Bertel Ullman, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you.
You are a distinguished scholar who started out at the University of Wisconsin and Oxford University, and you're now a leading expert on socialist and Marxist theory with dozens of books and articles to your credit. Tell us about your new role as president of the nonprofit IED, International Endowment for Democracy.
There's a number of progressive academics, lawyers, and activists who have noted the terrible contradiction between the attacks on democracy here in the United States and, at the same time, a great increase in the use of democracy talk in justifying our foreign policy and in going around the world using the language of promoting democracy while, in fact, subverting a whole variety of governments, including democratic ones, of which Washington disapproves. We wanted to take note of that, to oppose it, and because of the enormous impact that the American government has on the entire world, to give people everywhere an opportunity, if a small one, to participate in the difficult but necessary work of bringing real democracy to the United States.
Are things progressing in the way you hoped they would? I understand this was your idea, and did this happen roughly a year ago?
A year ago, I had the idea and began talking to a number of friends and comrades and others about it to see what could be done. But the organization actually went public by issuing out an appeal to the people of the world and a press release only a couple of months ago. So it's only really in the last couple of months that we've been active as an organization. I should say, by the way, a word about who's involved, because I think that gives most of what people will need to understand the character of what we're doing. It includes on the board of directors people like Howard Zinn, Gore Vidal, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Ramsey Clark, Michael Parenti, and a number of other people who have outstanding reputations as progressive scholars and activists and lawyers, both here in the United States and around the world. And we're united in trying to bring attention to this vanishing democracy in which we live and to try to do something about it in an unusual way, which is to, as I say, give an opportunity through our appeal for help from people abroad to try to get them involved in the struggles going on many fronts by Americans in trying to do something about what's happening to our democratic practices such as they are. We've also put up a rather substantial website, which I'd like to give you the address for. It's www.iefd.org. And on this website, we have, among other things, very large critical democracy library, about 100, over 100 articles and chapters of books on different aspects of democracy, particularly American democracy, critical of what's going on, with a lot of suggestions of what to do to make things better. And this, we hope, will be widely used by teachers and professors teaching courses that deal with democracy at both the college and high school level. So this is a hint to the teachers and professors in your audience who should take note of the address, have a look at the site, and suggest it to their students in courses of this kind. It's a free critical democracy library, which is unique. There's nothing like it on the web.
Professor Ullman, I want to ask you about the history of the term National Endowment for Democracy. I'm assuming that the name of that original NED organization, which was pretty far to the right, as I recall, and dates back really to corrupt dictators in Latin America, Iran-Contra, Ronald Reagan, and
That organization goes back to the early 1980s, and as one of their early leaders said, and this is quoted on our website because we have a section of the Democracy Library, there's a section on National Endowment for Hypocrisy Democracy, because they, and there's now several other groups like them also supported by the government, are doing what this former leader of the National Endowment said was work that used to be done by the CIA. So it's not so much work in promoting democracy, it's work in promoting the ends of the regime in Washington, which has very little interest in democracy, but interest in trying to get its way around the world, and it does so not only militarily, as we know, but through different kinds of subversion and overturning governments of which they disapprove. And some of those governments are far more democratic than ours, like the government in Venezuela, which had a real democratic election, which we in the United States haven't had since the last century, since before the year 2000. Through participation in the coup against Chavez. And they also had a role in overturning the democratically elected president, Aristide, in Haiti. This is what they do. And this is being done by various other groups now, which also have democracy in the title of their organization. And this is what I mean by this great increase in democracy talk, which is not only hypocritical, and I think this is terribly important because it's very easy for people who recognize that there's no democratic substance in this talk of democracy. It's very easy just to denounce it as hypocrisy, which it is. But it also plays an important role, which is, I think, to help cover what's happening to democracy in the United States, because I don't think Bush is our elected president. I think he and the Republicans stole the last two presidential elections, and we have, in effect, a usurper in office. And what has happened since with the war, war is plural, with the increase in repression of various kinds, the assault on our traditional civil liberties, also the policies conducted in the environmental area, total indifference to what's happening in the climate change in the world, and the pushing of neoliberal economic policies, which are harming poor people all over the world. What we see there is a growing distance being established between whatever there was of democracy several years, a decade ago and beyond, and what there is now, and that this growing indifference to a democracy in the United States, indeed hostility to it, is being covered over in part by a great increase, not a little, but a great increase in talk about democracy, particularly as a way of rationalizing our policy abroad. But perhaps a word should be said, too, in terms of getting a sense of what is special about our group, about what exactly, how exactly we understand democracy. And I think the best place to begin is probably with Abraham Lincoln's definition of democracy, although it had been used by other people as well, but he's the one who made it popular, where he's talking about rule of the people, which is the most simple definition of democracy going back 2,500 years to the ancient Greeks. How should we understand rule of the people in terms of what we call democracy in the United States? And his answer was that we should understand it as rule of, by, and for the people. Of, by, and for the people. And I think what we want to do at now is to break this down and to see in what sense we have rule of, by, and for the people in America. We have rule of the people in the sense that most people living in the United States, not everybody, are citizens and have certain rights like running for office and campaigning for candidates and voting in elections. Part of this, of course, is holding free and honest elections, in which we don't do anymore, not honest ones at least, and consequently we have democracy of the people in a much less perfect sense than we had, let's say, a decade or more ago, although in the early years of the Republic it was still more imperfect when people who didn't have a certain amount of property couldn't vote in elections, let alone women and slaves. If we come now to democracy by the people, we see that if there was some, and for a long period, let's say in the 20th century, substantial democracy in the sense of the people, in the sense of by the people, there's very, very little democracy in the United States, because at the national level, at least, we have rule by the rich and by their lawyers. The Senate, for example, is almost to a man and woman made up of millionaires. Certainly the whole cabinet is made up of millionaires, and these are not ordinary, typical Americans. So typical Americans, which is what is meant by the statement, rule by the people, simply don't have any control of the actual institutions of governmental power. Well, we move next to the third aspect of democracy, government for the people. Well, we find what one would expect if there is no government by the people. That is to say, the rich and their lawyers who control the institutions of government use their hands-on control of these institutions to make policies which serve them and people like them. And most of the policies and laws, regulations, which are passed and laid out by the government are not benefiting most of the people. And I think this is, you know, this is terribly clear throughout American history, not just in the most recent period. So what, if we take this definition then of democracy being government of, by, and for the people, what we see is that America really isn't a democracy. And I'm afraid, though things have gotten worse in the period since Bush stole the 2000 election, I think you want to see that a lot of this has gone on for the entire period of the Republic. And a good way to make that clear, I think, is to quote one of my favorite founding fathers, John Jay, who said at the time of the Constitutional Convention, quote, "The people who own the country ought to rule it," unquote. I think that was very clear. I think that was an expression of what most of the people that he was working with at the convention also thought. And this is really applied through most, indeed, through practically all of American history when one looks at democracy in terms of government of a rule of, by, and for the people.
Corporate powers or profit motives are so much more important lately than the welfare of the people. Just talk about that in what's going on in America today.
Again, you want to see this in the context of what's been happening for 200 years. The Constitution was put together in a way so that the rich and the powerful, then politically powerful, would continue to have the major say in how the country was run. And as James Madison, another major figure in the Constitutional Convention, said explicitly, we tried to create a document here which has the form of republicanism and democracy, but not its content, where the content is missing, where the people don't really rule, where it seems, where there's enough there where we can fool them into thinking that they are the rulers of the country, but that, in fact, this isn't the case. And there's in numerous ways in which they did this. For example, at the time of the Constitution, 12 of the 13 states which came together to form the United States, 12 of the 13 had important property qualifications for voting. So it's not only that women and blacks, slaves, couldn't vote, but most white males couldn't vote either. And the Constitution, you know, allows this. They don't say it specifically. What they do is they say we leave it to the states to decide who has the right to vote. Now, what happened over the next couple of hundred years is largely through struggles of workers and new immigrants and newly freed blacks and, of course, women. Through struggles, this the vote was expanded to larger groups in the population. But always in ways so that the basic framework of the country made it far more difficult for the great majority of the people to get things done where that involved serving their interests and harming the property interests of the wealthy. So any struggles which go on today, and of course a great many do, are struggles where all the rules of the game are benefiting the other side, are there in order to make it very difficult to change the status quo in any area where the interests of the wealthy are involved. And sometimes we can, if we enough of us get together and work hard enough, we can make a difference. And that has happened in the trade union movement and in a number of other struggles which have gone on and are going on.
When you talk about the wealthy, are you specifically talking about a certain kind of group of people? Are these corrupt corporate people like the ones we might find at Enron specifically?
No. They're just the ones who get in the news. It's the people who own the means of production, distribution, and exchange. The factories, the office buildings, the corporations, the land used for producing commercial crops, the big real estate operators. These are the wealthy. I'm not talking about the more wicked among them, the more dishonest among them. And of course, they vary. Some are more wicked, some are more dishonest. But I'm talking about just how they fit in the economy of the society. These are people who own America. And with ownership comes great wealth, and with great wealth comes power and status, and they don't want any of this to change. And indeed, they want it to increase, because wealthy people are never satisfied with what they have, as we can see in the current struggles going on about what Bush calls a tax reform, which is to give to the to the already obscenely wealthy still more. But these are the people I'm talking about, and they probably make up no more than a couple percent of the population. But they have lots of people helping them who they pay handsomely, their lawyers, their managers, their publicists, the media who present their point of view almost exclusively. So they have much more power than would be suggested by their actual numbers, which is why they are against the real rule of the people, because they represent so few people. And a real democracy would try to serve the interests of the great majority and would do so by trying to equalize the playing field, try to make sure that we all play on the same field with the same advantages and disadvantages, and that would have to mean achieving a really substantial degree of social and economic equality. And I'd go so far as to say that without that, because look what happens without that. Without that, that means the media are mostly controlled by the rich. That without that, it means that you have to be a millionaire to run for national office. So what I'm saying, and I think this is a position that is held by most members, maybe all members of the International Endowment for Democracy, is that in order to have a functioning political democracy, you really need to have a kind of social and economic equality, which is always been understood as a kind of socialism. Or to put it another way, for democracy to work, you need socialism. So just as socialism, in my thinking, and I think in the way of thinking of most socialists today, requires democracy, democracy also requires socialism, that these two are two arms of the same body, and you can't really have any existing well without the other.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. Roughly a year ago, you were writing about what you called the stolen election of 2004, and you were encouraging the left then to continue to investigate the 2004 election. Now, Greg Palast did continue to investigate, as did other reporters like Mark Crispin Miller.
Good book. He has a very fine book on Fooled Again. I strongly recommend it.
So now we do know a lot more about this stolen election. And
Well, why didn't we know right away? I mean, it's really ridiculous that it's taken us so long, or taken some people so long, to admit errors which were so evident and so widespread at that time. And I think one of the problems is that people were really, most people, were really operating with the wrong model of what constitutes a stolen election. By that I mean that most people were thinking that to speak of an election as being stolen, it had to look something like what occurs when there's a bank robbery. You know, the people, the robbers come out of the bank with the money under their arms and the guns in their hands. And then you can see that there's been a robbery in the bank. But I don't think that's the model on which to understand a stolen election. I think the model is more like what happens when there's a fixed card game, when someone before the game gets started, you know, stacks the deck, so that you know beforehand who's going to win, that the only one person has a chance to win. I think that is a stolen card game. And I think that this is the way that elections get stolen, that there's all sorts of rules in place and people in place and electronic election machines in place, which in fact are going to produce a particular result. And sometimes there's bits and pieces of that picture which emerges to the surface, and you can say, look, in this back room, there were 10 huge bags full of ballots, which were never counted. And so that's more like, you know, what happens in a bank robbery. But most of it, and particularly, let's say, what happens with the electronic voting machines, happens under the surface, and you have to know something about the companies which produce them, you know, what kind of commitments they've made to the Republicans. You have to know something about how little transparent these electronic voting machines are, how easy it is to hack into them, and of course you have to know something about what the election polls showed by the two pollsters who made the exit polls, and a poll also just before people went into the election booth about how they were going to vote, and what they showed was a victory by Kerry of about 5%. Now, we've never had polls showing anything like that margin before and proving wrong. They proved wrong this time because of the election was stacked. But one other thing, which is a good piece of evidence for knowing that we're dealing here with a stacked card deck, is that the Republicans did everything they could from 2000 to 2004 to keep the reforms, which everybody was talking about in a general way, which would have improved the situation, from actually being introduced. They are the ones who almost in every case benefited from the so-called irregularities which occurred, and they're the ones that did everything they could on the state and national level to make sure that changes wouldn't be made, which would make those kinds of irregularities more difficult or impossible.
Just wondering if you happened to see Greg Palast on Democracy Now! On the 14th of June.
I did. He was terrific. I love his work. Yes, he's done a fine job. I think he also mentioned the Kennedy article, which people interested in the subject matter should have a look at. Robert Kennedy had an article in Rolling Stone, which also is a very good compilation of the evidence for the stealing of our last election. But the point is that it's really too late to do too much about it as far as 2006 is concerned, and people are really not excited enough, and the media has not made enough of a fuss about it for doing what needs to be done before 2008. So there's grave doubts about whether we're going to be better served in 2008 than we were earlier. Now, if there was any other country where this sort of thing was happening, the shout would go up throughout the entire American media for sending election observers, for denouncing that country in all sorts of international forums and putting various other kinds of pressures on the government of that country. Whereas this happens in the United States, and people think because we talk the Democratic talk so much in this country that those kinds of shenanigans have little to do with whether we are or are not a democracy. We think it has a great deal to do with it, but it, as I pointed out, it isn't the only reason that our democracy is in trouble. I think what has happened in the elections of 2000 and 2004 was a kind of American tsunami, and the tsunami spoiled lots of election ballots, but it also sort of pulled the edge off of a very rotten system of social and economic inequality, which results in a variety of ways of the people not being able to rule in a country which prides itself on being a democracy.
I remember well what you're talking about with NED, and I certainly remember, you know, organizations like ProDemca, Friends of the Democratic Center, these sort of fake groups that were fundamentally propaganda and PAC organizations receiving money, changing the results of elections in Nicaragua and other countries in Latin America. So this is where you mentioned the Banana Republic aspect of things. But in reference to what the International Endowment might do in contrast to all of that, talk about some specifics of how you will look into elections and how you will promote democracy.
We are not an action organization. We are an organization which is making a critique, which is trying to publicize this critique, which is trying to bring non-Americans into the discussion going on here about American democracy, and which is trying to give the non-Americans an opportunity to offer modest material support to the variety of groups which exist, doing the kind of things that you just alluded to. There are a great many progressive groups doing good work out there. You mentioned one when you talked about Democracy Now! Most of them are quite small, and they're all hurting for money. And our idea was that there must be people around the world who would like to get involved in helping them. And so we see ourselves as a group of fairly well-known progressive scholars and lawyers and so on who know who these groups are, and we would be, you know, we will receive the money and pass it on to these groups. So we're not going to do the things you mentioned, but there's groups doing them, and we hope to be able to help them. And we hope to be able to publicize what they're doing, to help them too by publicizing what they're doing.
Now, talk a little bit, finally, about the international thrust of the group that you have just founded.
Well, we've sent out an appeal to the people of the world, telling them what's happening, giving our interpretation of it. We've indicated how they can help, but we're doing so in a language where a lot of what we're saying about the importance of social democracy, of creating the kind of socialist conditions which are necessary for building real democracy, where a lot of this applies to them as well as to us. That is to say, if, as I indicated earlier, socialism of some sort is necessary as a precondition for political democracy to work, a political democracy is necessary as a precondition for socialism to work, and that is, I think, a universal truth. So we are also making critical comments which apply to most of their countries, and therefore we hope that they'll take this into account in their own work, and that this will be passed around, and that this will play a role in the development of socialist democracies elsewhere besides the United States. Let me give an indication. I've just come back from a trip to a couple of countries in the Middle East, one of them being Turkey, and there I had a number of half a dozen media interviews and a couple of lectures. But the major thing I did there, which was really unusual, I think, is that a group of students formed a kind of student chapter of the International Endowment for Democracy, and they went around their campus with a big box on which was written in Turkish, Students of Turkey Help Save Democracy in the United States. And they were collecting nickels and dimes to help bring real democracy in the U.S. And they collected over $100. But the amount of money wasn't so important as the effort and the sharing with their fellow students and with the people of Turkey, because a lot of this appeared in the media in Turkey, what is necessary, why democracy is a good thing, because it's a terrific thing. We couldn't be more in favor of really rule of, by, and for the people. But we need to make clear what this is, what it requires, and how to go about building it. And we think that in trying to get other people in the world to help us in moving in this direction here, we can make a small contribution in helping them move their own governments in that direction where they live.
Just explain for us, you founded the International Endowment for Democracy, IED. It's going to be a nonprofit, but will it be in some ways politically partisan? And how will all of that work in terms of the groups you will choose to fund?
We're not accepting money from governments or groups which are involved in violent action of any sort. That's been laid out and made very explicit in terms of our request for help. As far as who we're passing money on to, we're not going to give money, obviously, to the American government, nor are we going to give money to any political party. But that leaves an awful lot of progressive groups, and we've talked in a general way. We haven't had the discussion yet about which groups to actually give money to, but we have had a discussion about our priorities, and we've decided that our highest priorities are groups involved in labor struggles, groups involved in progressive media, groups involved in the area of education, and groups involved in trying to clarify what happened in our and publicize what happened in our last two stolen elections. So those would be the kind of groups, progressive groups, who are not trying to help the Democratic Party, let's say, win, but are trying to move forward the democracy, real democracy in the United States, in the areas that I mentioned.
Bertel Ullman is president of the nonprofit IED, International Endowment for Democracy, and author of Dance of the Dialectic, Steps in Marx's Method, and Alienation, Marx's Conception of Man in Capitalist Society. The website, IEFD.org. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. Talk Nation Radio is produced in the studios of WHUS Radio at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. TalkNation.org and TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts and discussion within the new CAFE discussion group.